Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour for April 14th, 2022. And tonight, a very interesting set of topics in this ongoing series where I'm talking about my decades of discoveries with a lot of anecdotes mixed in to give you a flavor of what was going on in all of the years that I encountered the craziness of modern science. Tonight, I want to start out with a story about the three-part comet paper. Now, this is republished in the appendix number 2 of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. In one of the primary discoveries that came out of cometary science in the last many decades was that comets produce X-rays. Not only do they produce X-rays, but out to the sunward side. And so anyway, I want to go back to my 1981 paper, which was published in a peer-reviewed journal, not one that was dealing with astrophysics, but still peer-reviewed. And I want to read this quote. Now, 1996, accidentally, some astronomers working for NASA pointed an X-ray detector at a comet. And I'm not sure why they did that, but they noticed that there was this X-ray cloud out to the sunward side. And then they pointed that was Comet Hyakutake. And then they pointed the same telescope towards Comet Hale-Bopp, which was in the solar system at that time, detected X-rays there. And they go, holy cow, comets have X-rays. And there was a big flurry of activity. But I want to read something. Now, this is from the part 2 of the 3-part comet paper. And this is in a little section, the appendix 2 of the actual part 2 of the paper. Now, this is an extensive set of papers. And if you read this, it's really dense. And so I'm going to go through little bits and pieces of this, but you'll have to read the entire papers yourself. But this deals with experiments which will verify presently proposed theory for comet behavior. In other words, I'm telling what will come in the future to verify my theory compared to the, at the time, called the ice ball comet model, which later morphed into the present-day dirty snowball comet model. Okay, so I'm going to read this. This is point number 5. The most conclusive evidence conclusive evidence would come if one of the spacecraft would be diverted to pass between the comet nucleus and the sun. This is predating the actual satellites that went out to visit comets. Reading on, the ice ball comet model would not anticipate any alteration in the solar wind in this area, since the ice ball is seen only to melt away in the tail direction. The present theory, however, would expect the following. As the satellite approached the point between the sun and the nucleus in the region of the comet nucleus, first, an intensified proton wind would be detected, followed by a substantial current of electrons, the electrons moving towards the comet nucleus at the point between the sun and the comet nucleus. This would be followed again by an intensified proton wind. This would substantiate the electrical discharge nature of comets as opposed to an ice ball melted by solar radiation. Well, it just so happens that a number of years later, the comet that went by the probe from the European Space Agency called Giotto, the French actually built this, and Giotto being a painter, French painter, went between the nucleus of Halley's Comet and the sun and detected exactly that. And in fact, it detected such an intense electron beam that it was completely thrown off course. And oddly enough, it did not have an X-ray detector on board. Otherwise, it would have detected massive amounts of X-rays. Now, point number 6. Even if the spacecraft are not diverted into the region between the sun and comet nucleus, the current sheets just mentioned should be detected as the spacecraft approached the comet. Now, number 7. Now, remember, this was physically discovered, never anticipated by anybody else, a complete surprise to NASA in 1996. it was touted as the major discovery, one of the 10 major discoveries of 1996 from Discover magazine. This is my point number 7, written, mind you, now this was written in my original 300-page book that I had with me when I went to Cornell University in 1979. Now, point number 7, X-ray activity may be detectable in the vicinity of the comet nucleus. As the point number 8, if the cometary discharges become intense enough in the comets being studied, both cosmic rays and X-rays and possibly gamma rays may be detected, and none of these phenomena have been studied by Earth-based investigators, and comets were believed to be melting ice. The author cannot overstress the complexity of reactions, both chemical and nuclear, that must occur in highly active comet in which particle energies rise in excess of 20 to 30 MeVs, million electron volts. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And this is the prediction that I made literally decades before these measurements were made. And I also talk about, going back to point 4, if the satellites, talking about artificial satellites, pass too close to the comet nucleus, they may be uncontrollably pulled into the comet nucleus for the same reasons. And so this actually happened with the Giotto spacecraft. I mean, these are all things that I listed prior to any spacecraft ever going out to a spacecraft. Okay, I'll go back here. Here's another one. Spacecraft telemetry. I'll just go back to number 1. Tail material, positive ions, positively charged dust particles will be detected by direct observation to move towards the comet nucleus. Previously, Earth-based redshift measurements have been used to suggest that the tail material moves away from the comet nucleus. And so, anyway, then point number 2, spacecraft telemetry will begin to sense an acceleration towards the comet nucleus, far in excess of any expected gravitational field from a small ice ball. This is the result of the induced electric dipole force in the middle spacecraft. This will also make it difficult to maintain spacecraft orientation while in the tail area. And this, once again, is exactly what happened with the Giotto spacecraft. Then point number 3, this acceleration will cause unexpected perturbation in the orbit of the satellite as it emerges from the comet tail. In contrast, negligible perturbation would be expected with a near massless ice ball. Okay, so these are major predictions, and they all came true. Now, this is the result. This is just not some magical pie-in-the-sky estimation. This is because of the physical properties of the plasma discharge comet model. The X-ray beam coming out from the sun on the nose side, the sunward side of the comet and the comet nucleus. I made these predictions, and of course, when these were discovered, I knew the people at Goddard, they knew me, and I called them up and I said, look, I predicted this, I sent these portions of the paper to them, and there was fear and loathing once again within the Goddard Los Alamos groups of people, and they would not publicize the fact that this was predicted. Now, once again, this is a Nobel Prize winning prediction, where due to a theoretical model, you predict something that was totally, absolutely, totally unexpected. And, of course, they whitewashed this entire thing with a guy named Tom Cravens, who came out and said, oh, this is just due to charge exchange. And that went on for a number of years until a group from Europe came in and said, no, the type of X-rays detected were Bremsstrahlung, breaking X-rays, not charge exchange X-rays. You can tell the difference in the data. And so NASA ignored the data, did not bring in experts who knew what Bremsstrahlung X-rays looked like. I would have told them, I did tell them that. Okay, so at any rate, and then a number of weeks ago, let me see, it was in the March 24th show, I told you that at the very beginning I was going to tell you where the term electric universe came from, because that's a term that's bantered around the internet and YouTube channels quite frequently today. But the real term came from my set of papers here. And so I'm just going to scroll down here and okay, just give me a second to pull this up here. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here. And this is from the end, right before the conclusion of the three-part comet paper, the third part. And so this is going through a lot of the other detail, like the induced electric dipole redshift, and talking about the failure of standard theoretical physics in cosmology. And I'll just read a few paragraphs here to give you the tone, and then you'll see where the term electric universe came from. Okay, so, and there's a tremendous amount of other information here, but this just gives you the tone of where this term came from. The Red Hand of Death spoken of in ancient legends, I'm talking about the Egyptian Red Hand of Death, when the talking about Moses, the descriptions in the Old Testament. So the Red Hand of Death spoken of in ancient legends may have been auroras caused by the current sheet between the comet Venus and Earth, just as Io's current sheet causes the visible auroras as it passes over Jupiter's dark side. Or it may have been the visual effects of flaming hydrocarbons, oils, and tars as they rained into Earth's atmosphere from Venus' huge cometary tail. The columns of smoke extending into the clouds. Now, I'm talking about the Moses event, the Venus event, when they're leaving Egypt and they have all of this major catastrophe going on. Okay, reading here. The columns of smoke extending into the clouds that sounded as tremendous drumming occurred when the comet to Earth discharge became a single beam snaking between the comet and Earth. Numerous other historically observed phenomena can be correlated to the present theory and will be the topics of future papers. And just another one to insert here, when all of the frogs and vermin and insects and snakes came out of the ground during this time, when the plagues, the seven plagues that plagued Pharaoh before the Israelites left Egypt, one of them was the insects and all of this, the things that live in the ground coming up out of the ground. And I told you this story before, where when I was a little kid, we would go get the car battery and we wanted to go fishing. We wanted to get some worms. We'd put the a lead from each one of the battery cables down into the ground a number of feet, and out would come all of the worms. They would just come up to the surface. You'd pick them up and put them in your can, and you did not have to dig a hole with a shovel. It was so anyway, that's what happens when electrical currents go in the ground. It forces all of these things to come up out of the ground. Okay, reading on, questions still remain concerning the birth for Venus, but there is mounting evidence suggesting that Venus is indeed a youthful planet and could very well have been the comet of the ancients that Velikovsky identified and discussed in Worlds in Collision. And remember, this paper was finally after I learned about Velikovsky. This is published after I was out of Cornell, and I finally found out, a friend of mine said, it sounds like you're talking the same kind of talk as this Velikovsky guy, and so I went and looked it up. And so this paper was eventually published in Kronos, which I'll talk a little bit about here, kind of an odd situation for me, learning about this, but then having a place to actually publish. Okay, so now, where did the term electric universe come from? Okay, you'll find out in the next paragraph. Reading on here, it says, since scientists confront Velikovsky, which was written by none other than Carl Sagan, and then the 1974 American Association for the Advancement of Science Velikovsky trial. Okay, reading on, more cosmological data has been gathered than had been accumulated in the previous 300 years. A a catastrophic bandwagon has been formed in astronomy, geology, evolutionary biology, and related fields, but with no credit given to Velikovsky. So they were actually robbing Velikovsky's material after burying him and kind of morphing into this semi-catastrophic mode where eventually NASA was talking about asteroids colliding with Earth. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize winner that was adamant that holes in the ground were the result of collisions with asteroids. Okay, so I've kind of interrupted this paragraph, so I'm going to go back and read it again because it's so vitally important here. Since Scientists Confront Velikovsky, that's a book written by Carl Sagan, Scientists Confront Velikovsky, it was edited by Sagan, there were a lot of contributors there. Okay, and the 1974 American Association for the Advancement of Science Velikovsky trial, more cosmological data has been gathered than had been accumulated in the previous 300 years. A catastrophic bandwagon has been formed in astronomy, geology, evolutionary biology, and related fields, but with no credit given to Velikovsky. His data and observation pointed towards an electrical universe. Epochs of celestial catastrophes affecting Earth let the reader decide. Velikovsky's main difficulty was that of a man far ahead of his time in a world of academic elitism. He disagreed with the experts who used their resources to label him a crackpot. In discrediting Velikovsky, Sagan et al. Simply restated traditional theories, and it became apparent that catastrophism did not fit. As stated by Carl Sagan, of the 10 tests of Velikovsky's work, there is not one case where his ideas are consistent with simple physical theory and observation. Okay, so anyway, there is where the term electrical universe came from. And then I used that term in my work. It finally got stolen in 2004 by a con man. I will be talking about these people. Who were funded basically by the CIA, because in 2004, I was well on my way to I was already had my own radio show. In the 1990s, I had been on Art Bell's show as a main guest. In the 1990s, when the whole Hale-Bopp fiasco was going on, I was a regular guest with Art Bell, and talking about this and the other main issues, and I'll talk about that later. But by the year 2004, when that rolled around, I had been a guest on probably every major radio show in the United States at the time, and some of the very biggest ones, of course, with Chuck Schramm in Texas and Alex Merklinger, and, of course, Coast to Coast AM. Once George Nori took that over, I was a guest there. And, you know, other major venues. I was a keynote speaker at the International UFO Congress 2 years in a row, talking about Tesla, talking about the one-year Planet X, and then also talking about electric highways to the stars. You can see my videos of that in my video collection, the hard copies of the DVDs that I sell on my webpage. So anyway, by the time 2004 rolled around, and the CIA came in and funded an extremely valueless person. And I'll just name, because he formed a little group and started basically robbing my material. But what's very interesting is they had handlers. All the time that they were doing this, they had handlers. And the very first handler was none other than Tom Van Flandern, from the Naval Observatory, who was the assistant to Robert Harrington. Remember, Harrington had discovered Planet X and then died shortly afterwards, back in the 1991. Tom Van Flandern was his assistant, and it was Tom Van Flandern that actually promoted this in the Naval Observatory, got NASA to fund this effort to find Planet X, which turned out to be the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. And so all of this had gone on. And so here we roll up to 2004, where Talbot runs out and makes up his merry little band of plagiarists. And lo and behold, who does the CIA put in as a handler but Tom Van Flandern? Now, Van Flandern, interestingly enough, had a webpage that said that there was a Planet X which crashed into another planet and blew it all to smithereens, and that's where the asteroid belt came from. But publicly, Van Flandern, even though he kept that page, stated there could be no such Planet X that would affect Earth. I was like, wait a minute, this is totally contradictory information. But anyway, so Van Flandern had to maintain his silence about any issues regarding Planet X. And so they had to form controlled opposition. And that's the entire point, controlled opposition replacing me and putting, and so they stole the term electric universe. So I'm showing you here where that term came from, because we'll get into all of this detail later on when those years come around. And that's later in the year, in fact, in this series. But it's very important to put all this together right now. Now, I want to talk a little bit. I got to pick up a few topics, but from previous weeks, the tying up loose ends here. So that from the March 24th show, I had promised at the beginning of the show I would tell you where the term electric universe came from, so I just did that. And we'll be talking about that a bit later also. The other topics that were left over from actually last week, and I'll be talking a little bit about this confrontation I had at Cornell the last couple of weeks I was there. And then after that, I remember I went up to Canada, and I went there on a mining claim to begin with some people that I knew. And but the majority of the from May, after I got back from Cornell, I had to just get out and air out, because it was an extremely difficult situation dealing with the corruption at Cornell, the absolute corruption. And so anyway, I went up on these river systems and canoeing and fishing and living off fish. And I'll just tell you kind of a little anecdote here. I would take the fish that was left over from the day and the fillets. There was walleye and northern primarily from these big river systems way up in central Canada. I mean, there was just nobody up there. You never saw other people. You would see bear and moose with the closest thing to people that you would see. But for months, working on up and down these river systems in central Canada that run east and west. But I would take the fish that were left over from the day, and I would put them on a rock for the night next to the fire. And by morning, they would be jerky, fish jerky, literally. In a day, two, three, 4 days later, if we were busy doing something else in the woods or something and didn't have time to fish, I would be eating the fish jerky. And much to the chagrin of these other people. But anyway, then as the fall came, as I said, I stayed there and went into winter and literally lived outside by myself through until February, if you can imagine that, in the middle of the Canadian wilderness. But a very important epoch in my life to get a hold of this connection that you need to the universe. And it's not something you can explain. Only people who have done this have even a clue of what happens. Now, you have the Sherpas in Peru. You have the other groups of people that go on sometimes communally, sometimes individually. And let's go back to the Spartans. When the Spartans' youth grew up, they had to, on their own, they would send them out with nothing. Literally nothing. You go out into the wilderness and you don't come back until you have mastered the ability to live on your own. And of course, I'm sure some did not make it back. But there's actually a good scene on this. In the movie 300, there's a little segment on that But going off into the wilderness by yourself is something that people that, I'm not comparing myself to anybody, but you have to understand the people that really had to deal with monumental efforts did take time out and to go out into the wilderness. And even you'll find people like David and the David and Goliath situation. David spent a lot of time out in the wilderness as he was he was herding his sheep, of course. But anyway, it was a very important epic in my life. So possibly I'll talk about some more of the anecdotes, and people will say, well, where did you sleep? Well, I did not have a tent. I didn't have a fire. And the one thing I had to do was I had to sleep on the downside of trees, because in the middle of the night, the moose would come running down through the woods and go down to the river where they would drink and fill up on water. And so if you were not on the downside of a tree, you would get trampled, because you never knew where the moose were going to come through the woods. A few little anecdotes on survival. And of course, a very pristine environment, very pure water, very pure food environment. And so another little anecdote I want to talk about here is, after I had come back from Canada to civilization, one of the first things I did is I went out looking for a job. And at the time, the work environment was very rich. And so I went to some high-tech companies, and I got a job as in a high-secure location in the telecommunications industry. And my first position in this company was using my math physics background for doing modeling. This is performance modeling on telecommunications computers. These were IBM-compatible front-end processors. These were the machines, the computers that offloaded the telecommunication function from IBM mainframe legacy computers called front-end processors. So this is in the year about 1981 going into 82, somewhere in that time frame. It may have been into 1982, but it would have been 1982 around February to March, so kind of springtime. So just in the question of timing, I was at Cornell from 1979 fall semester to spring semester. It was a two-semester system there at Cornell at the time. And so up to the spring semester of 1981, in which case I left Cornell, left Ithaca, and went back and found myself going into Central Canada, as I've described. And as I said, I started, this would have been a May-June time frame in 1981, to then travel through Central Canada by canoe, living basically off of fish, etc., and berries and other fruit, foods that came from the woods, and very minimal amount of food that had with me. And then from there, stayed on in the fall of 1981. And so then as fall came around, I just stayed there in Central Canada. And then as winter set in, I stayed there and kept staying there. And like I said, I bathed in the river until it froze, till the day it froze. And then you were still able to get water by punching a hole through the water. Through the ice, but you become acclimated to this. As a kid, when I was young, I had a dog, and a big golden Labrador, and so I would walk him in the wintertime because I lived in Minnesota, and of course it could get to 20 or 30 below zero, and I got to the point where I could walk the dog in my t-shirt. And you think, good grief, you know, but your body acclimates to this cold. And then, of course, I'd come back home and be in a nice warm house. But your body acclimates to this. And what actually happens physiologically is the small blood vessels at the surface of your skin minimize, so you're not transferring a lot of heat out of your through your skin. And it it keeps a minimal amount of blood flow to your skin. So there's actually a physiological process that goes on if you live in the colder climates. Just like if you live in a warmer climate, you have a lot more blood activity towards your skin, so you can get rid of heat faster, because your body is always typically warmer than the outside ambient temperature. But in a tropical situation, it's so close that there's not a lot of heat flow. There's not a lot of heat transfer, and you have to keep your body cooled down. So at any rate, then it was, I stayed until around February of 1982 in central Canada, in which case I turned around and I came back and I said, okay. And when I hit, it was in Minneapolis, I was basically in perfect physical, mental, spiritual condition. I could have wrestled a bear or a wolf in the woods. And so anyway, there's other stories related to that. But very good physical, mental, spiritual condition. And when I went out, I got the very first job I applied for. The one with the company doing front-end processors. And let me explain a little bit about that. I was in a group with about 20 people. They were statisticians. They were mathematicians. I was the only physicist there. But I had a background in statistics and mathematics also with my double major and et cetera. So I, and of course, teaching university-level mathematics and physics. So what we did is this company made a competing product for the IBM manufactured products. And the telecommunication computer is probably one of the most complicated computers in existence because it works on timing. It can't just sit there and do things at its own pace. In telecommunications, timing is everything. And so then you had a big bus cable with 128 cables that plugged into the IBM mainframe to take all the telecommunications off of the offloading the mainframe computer. In the early days, the IBM legacy computers actually did the telecommunication function, and they soon realized you needed a separate computer that just did telecommunications. And so what we did in my group was to model, we designed our own processor chips, our own instruction sets that were optimized for telecommunications. And so I worked also with the electrical engineers and the chip designers and the people who actually built those. So it was an interface with about another probably 50 engineers who were doing this engineering. And then there were the software people also who wrote the software that ran on our custom chips and memory sets, etc. And so then, after working in that group for a number of years, I was plucked out of there by the systems engineering group. And that's where you actually do the design work for the hardware and the new products that come along. And so what I wrote were hardware specifications and functional specifications, which later came in handy when I designed the wing generator, by the way, because when you write a functional specification, it does not say anything about the parts that are used or other. It's a higher level document, and it says what this thing should do. What are its requirements? What are its boundaries? What are its limitations? How does it interface with prior and future equipment? How does it interface with industry standards? I started going to the IEEE ANSI meetings for example, I was involved in the specification of Ethernet, the 602 protocols. I went to the meetings, international meetings, and where these protocols were designed and hammered out in all the specifications. And now those specifications are just absolutely included. People don't think about them anymore. But I was in the original design groups, and then involved in encryption, and this is where I got really involved in encryption at all levels of hardware and high-level software design work. So what my specifications did is they set the engineers working on one side and they set the software programmers working on the other side. And this all had to work together, and timing was essential because when messages came in or out, you had to process. We were dealing with multiple speed circuits all the way down to back in the day when there were 9.6 kilobit per second circuits, if you can imagine this. Now everything is up in the megabit per second range, even for home computers. And this is also in the legacy days when the distributed networking was coming about, and the companies, and our company should have grown into many of those companies because we had the talent, we had the wherewithal, but we had a turnover in leadership, and unfortunately this company went out and started hiring MBAs to operate the company, and anybody who's an engineer will understand this story is very common. Back in the old days, the engineers were the presidents of the companies. They grew up in the company and eventually graduated to be president, vice president, head of sales, etc. And so the company started hiring MBAs, and they would come in and they'd go, well, we're going to make this change here. And they had to do something because they really didn't know anything. So they basically destroyed the company within a period of about 5 years. The company went out of business. And eventually was bought by NCR and then AT&T. Finally became an employee of AT&T at the very end. But it was the same company. I mean, we did the very same thing. And, of course, AT&T and other computer companies were interested in our products and product ability because of the very unique part of telecommunications back in the legacy days. And then the legacy computers started to be replaced with distributed networking, and that's when the personal computer took off, etc. So that's a whole other story. But anyway, after this company went out of business, and this I'll get into later because there's some certain timings, but all of this time, for about a 10-year period I worked at this company, it gave me the invisibility, I will say that. Nobody knew where I worked. None of the old NASA guys. I would go to meetings. I would pay for my own way. I would go to the American Geophysical Union meetings. I'd fly out to Los Alamos. I would go to Los Angeles. I would be out in other parts of the country, Maryland, at Goddard Space Flight Center. And nobody knew where I worked. Nobody knew anything about me because I had this high security job in the telecommunications industry. And so they couldn't get at my income, is my point, of that I could maintain with a very nice salary, very nice lifestyle, continue all my scientific work, go to the meetings, and proceed with my scientific endeavors, and of course, very well known in Tier 1 science, etc. And some of those people knew a bit more about me because they do. They simply know about your private life. And they would come out, and when they talked to me, they'd say, you just keep doing what you're doing. We got your back covered. That's what they would tell me, because they would learn a lot from what I was doing, because all of this time I was progressing. Everything that I've told you so far, everything had progression into the future. And I was refining, I was advancing the frontier of the knowledge of electrical conditions in the solar system, how comets worked. In the mid-1980s, we had the flurry of comet activity, the Comet Halley, the ISWE-3 satellites, which were later called ICE-3, as they went out to Jacobini's Inner. And so I was involved in all of this. But as I say, I had this hidden lifestyle that nobody knew about. And the people who hated me, because there were people who really liked me, worked, loved what I was doing, etc., and knew that I was involved in Tier 1 science, and I'll get back to the 1982 period. But I had a place to be, a place to make income, a good lifestyle, etc. Okay, so going back to 1982, so I come back, I'm in Minneapolis, I'm working as a high-level high security engineer in a telecommunications company. And by the way, There was no hacking back then. We never had a network hack. We sold computing systems of the front-end processors, telecommunications computers to all of the European governments, the United States government. We sold to the Japanese government. We sold to banks. All of the major banks had our equipment. All of the major oil companies had our equipment and a lot of smaller companies. And we started building smaller machines for other companies that were running legacy equipment. And then as the distributed networking came about, those distributed networks still came and communicated with the legacy IBM mainframe computers. That went on for a while until finally the conversion came long after I was out of that particular industry. The legacy computers finally bit the dust. And that's when IBM really didn't plan it. You had companies like say, Eastman Kodak, who was making chemical film for photographs, for photography, did not understand the adventure, the beginning of the digital era. Another note in going off into the future, I had a second job eventually after this job faded away. I did a number of things, and I'll talk about that in the future. I'm not going to deal with that now. But I had another high-level engineering job in the telecommunications industry later for about a period of 15 years, which gives you a total of 25 years in the telecommunications industry. And that job also, high-level job, very well-paying, kept me hidden also because it was a high-level, high-security job, and what kept me hidden from the NASA people during that epoch also because they were always hunting me down. And I've already talked about the story about Dan Golden in the with Tony Scarpelli. I talked about that story. So all through the history, NASA was very aware of me and my work, but they never could find me and go after my income because that's what they do. They go after your income. And just by the way, when YouTube first came out, this YouTube was a phenomenon. It started to grow. Everybody was putting YouTube, YouTube, YouTube. I was banned from YouTube from the very beginning. And that's because NASA hooked into YouTube also, and so did some of its constructed opposition. And so I was banned from YouTube long before Alex Jones, long before anybody else was banned from YouTube. I was officially banned from YouTube. If I put up a video, it would be gone immediately, censored. And if somebody had a video up and some person out there put a blog note in under the video, it would be immediately removed. So this has been going on with me since the beginning of YouTube, so for literally decades, long before the modern high-tech censoring that's going on. But anyway, my point was that, so my career, just to outline my career in general, after I left Cornell, and including the 2 years in Cornell, I spent about 10 years teaching at the university level. So my subjects were math, physics, computer science, of course, and astronomy in a job that I had where I was teaching in a university system, a state university system for a couple of years. I taught astronomy, and my astronomy classes grew from 30 students a single session to about 150 students per quarter. That was on a quarter system. And the students loved my teaching. You know, it's one thing I have is a very good ability to stand in front of crowds, and like I gave talks at the International UFO Congress, 1,200 people in the audience, and of course on live radio, live TV of Russia and Japan, and so I had very good stage presence at Cornell. The 395 students signed a petition to have me continue teaching their class of calculus when I took it over for a professor who had left. And at any rate, so about 10 years of my career teaching physics, math, computer science, and astronomy at the university level, and then about 25 years of my career in the telecommunications industry, just to give you an outline. And of course, I never talked about this when I was on radio shows all of those years. I never mentioned it. Nobody knew anything about me. They just knew James McCanney as the, you know, the electrical universe, the plasma discharge comet model, and during the Planet X days through the 1990s and the 2000s and all the insanity that went on there. And then in the 2012 World is Going to End Mayan calendar days, you know, I was front and center there and all the way up to today. So this is decades and decades, just giving you a little piece of history. And then I had many of my own companies, and I'll be talking about that in the future, but I just wanted to run this. But the thing I wanted to mention about the telecommunications positions is it positioned me for eventually solving and understanding the significance of solving the prime number problem, and which is now in printed in Calculate Primes, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. Those are the first two books that came out in 2007 and 2014. And then the ongoing series, it's called Principles of Prime Numbers. It's a three-volume set. One volume has already been released. And so at any rate, I just wanted to give a little bit of that history leading up to some of the modern events. Okay, so jumping back, let me go back. I was trying to pick up some of these notes here. And, I wanted to talk about those last few weeks at Cornell. Now, I've told this story before, so I think you understand what's going on if you listen to my previous shows this year, giving a summary. But what I did is I realized, okay, number one, I was walking on very thin ice because I already had, I already knew that I was being blackballed from journals because I was getting the feedback directly from the editors saying that these guys are after you. They do not want you to publish, and they're after the editors. And I mentioned Zenit Kopal. He was the editor of Astrophysics and Space Science and a whole list of other European journals. He was the main man in across the pond in England and Europe regarding astrophysics, space science, and astronomy. And he was getting tremendous pressure from the Cornell boys, Carl Sagan and the boys there. And then, of course, they were writing to all of the other journals. And, of course, I was already blackballed from the Cornell space science journal called Icarus. And so it was very clear that I was going to have problems continuing to publish because my work was just not welcome. Talking about planets forming from comets in an epic of Carl Sagan was like puking in the middle of your grandmother's funeral. It just was not welcome. Let's just put it that way. I excuse the expression there. I mean, I can't think of anything more apropos than to something just outlandish, you know. But the last few weeks I was at Cornell, at that point, I already knew. I had my discussion with Wolfgang Fuchs, the chairman of the math department. He had already told me they were trying to fire me from the astronomy department because they had already done it from the physics department, of course, a year and a half earlier. And so I knew that, okay, the gloves are off. Gloves are off. So I wrote up a one-page accusation accusing NASA, Carl Sagan and the astronomy department and NASA, because Cornell had a huge volume of professional space scientists from NASA working at Cornell. They were housed there. And of course, they could go to JPL or Goddard or one of the other major centers, but they were actually housed and paid at Cornell through money that flowed through Cornell from NASA. And so they were resident at Cornell. And so there was a lot of them. I mean, there was probably, I would say, between 30 and 50 of them. I accused them publicly in my one pager of fudging data, of protecting their pet theories, basically, which would be a criminal offense if you took it actually at its face value, where they were taking government funding, using government money to bolster their pet theories to prevent other people from publishing, which was actually the case with me, obviously, because I had published in peer-reviewed journals. And if you take me aside from anybody else in the whole history of working on this issue of electricity in outer space, I'm the only one that published in peer-reviewed journals. And you might take a few people like Hans Alvin or a few other ones, and even he had tremendous resistance. So this is nothing new, and he won a Nobel Prize for his work dealing with issues of electromagnetism in outer space. But a very rudimentary knowledge at the time he was working. So anyway, I was in a unique position. And so I basically on campus wrote a one-pager, and I sent it to the entire faculty through campus mail. And needless to say, and I said, I'm going to follow up with this, and I'm going to, you know, basically, I would like to talk to anybody that's willing to talk. And so I went on campus, department by department, professor by professor, and of course, Cornell is a big university, so that's a lot of people who received this. And by the way, there was a book that was written at around the same time that was talking and mentioned some of the people that I've been mentioning, head of the physics department, head of other departments, and the backbiting and the politicization of knowledge at Cornell and how this was structured, etc. There was an actual book that came out, kind of like a novel, or kind of like, what would you call it, one of those cheap dime store novels that, you know, you pick up, but it was kind of a sleazy rendition of the people at Cornell. And so anyway, that all aside, I'm not the only person who was trying to expose this, and of course I was doing it on purely scientific level. Okay, so anyway, I send this around, and then I start going around and I start talking to individual professors, and I went to all of them. And I told you the story already about how I went into the geology department, and I had an appointment to talk to one of the professors there, and apparently he had not gotten tenure yet. He was on a tenure track. And I came in and I asked the secretary, and I could see through the door there to the head of the chairman of the geology department sitting back there. He had the first office somewhat visible behind the secretary's desk. And I asked if I could speak with whoever it was there, as I had an appointment. And, you know, she was going to go see if he was in, go get the guy to talk to me. And out of this office, head of the geology department screams at the top of his lungs so that everybody could hear it, "If anybody in this department talks to McCanny, they will not get tenure." In other words, and needless to say, nobody came out to talk to me. That was one experience. Another experience, I walked into the newly formed archaeoastronomy department, and the head of the department got up and he shook my hand. He stood up and he said, I can't believe you're doing this. I can't support you because I would lose my job and I would lose my newly founded department." And of course, that was a big thing. Archaeoastronomy had become an official, notarized, bona fide subject of study at Cornell. So this guy was sitting on a platform unbelievably important. It would be almost like astrology becoming into a department, because for astronomers to allow archaeology to somehow dictate interpretation of astronomical issues would be obscene. So it's clearly a top-down from the astronomy department over this guy. He had to march to a special tune or he knew he was out of there. And of course, I'm sitting on the information of the Mayans. I had been in Mexico. I had been at the ruins. I had seen the Quetzal bird fly over my head. I knew the imagery of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, who had tidal waves and mountain building and poisoned the air and had battles up in the sky with other deities, comets, etc. So I knew all of this, and here's a guy, head of the archaeoastronomy department at Cornell, who could not talk about any of this with me, certainly not in public, nor could he breach these topics in the archaeological world. So it's very important to understand. And then I went around and I talked to literally everybody there. My good friend Hans Bethe, I had to go in and bid adieu to him. And that's the last time I saw him, of course, or communicated with him. But I had spent time with Hans there. I'd go up to his office on a not regular basis, but yes, I would say somewhat regular basis, and talk to him about solar physics and publication, etc. Just other people that I had gotten to know there. So it was an amazing experience to go through this, and then knowing that I'm on the way out, because then I got my letter basically stating that I would not be renewed for the following semester. But in the last couple of minutes here, I want to give a special mention to a guy that was really an amazing scientist, was independent. He did not work for NASA. He was from England. His name was Stan Dermott. And I talked to him, not a lot, but quite a bit there, in discussing the comet theories, etc. And he was always very open. He was always very open, a very quiet, soft-spoken person. I understand he's still alive. And so I hope that with all of the derogatory commentary that I give around Cornell, there were some bright spots there, and Stan Dermott was one of them. When I first talked to him about comets and the circle of equal force and other aspects of the mathematics of the plasma discharge comet model, he wrote down and he made some calculations. And, you know, he was a scientist. He was an independent scientist. And I understand he had an asteroid named after him, 3647, something like that. But in a world where this was in a time when the independent scientist was simply being eliminated. And so Stan's work dealt with the orbital dynamics of moons, where they, if they were in the same orbit, they would not collide. They would do this little dance and not collide. And so anyway, he did some other work on orbital dynamics, and I believe he even wrote a textbook that is one of the standards now probably for graduate work in celestial mechanics. But Stan Dermott, my hat's off to people like that, who are the last of the independent scientists. And when I went to meetings, I was always put my name tag on as independent scientist, so I'm very proud of that. There were a few people left. Good scientists, honest scientists. Anyway, I'm out of time. I'll be talking to you again next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.